Loose Ends with Clive Anderson.
Yes, hello and welcome to Loose Ends. And with the exciting news that Gordon Brown is going to be giving evidence to the Chilcot inquiry before the general election, or while he's still Prime Minister, as it's usually described, what top-ranking figures are we going to hear from today in this star chamber of the airways? Well, last Saturday we had a highly impressive array of acting talent on the programme, but I think we can match that this week as we have thespian excellence coming out of our ears, or rather going into yours. Sir Ian McKellen, one of our greatest theatrical and indeed cinematographical knights, is just one of our guests. In addition, in a packed studio, we have the star, director and executive producer of Channel 4's long-running drama Shameless, all of whom come in the form of David Threlfall, who has had a big success playing the perpetual loser, Frank Gallagher. But we're not just featuring acting performing, no, we will also be considering what many people describe as the greatest tool for the spreading of human knowledge since the invention of the printing press, the internet and all its works. Alex Kratosky has made a four-part series on the rise and spread of the World Wide Web, but encyclopedic knowledge and Twitter brings us to Richard Herring, who'll be giving us a slice of his well-informed stand-up show. And we'll have music from Marcus Bonfanti and Fife Dangerfield. And Joe Bunting is our guest interviewer.
I'll be talking to Catherine Hibbert, who decided to spend an entire year skipping. Now, this wasn't another attempt by somebody tedious to get into the Guinness Book of Records. For 12 months, Catherine dispensed with money completely, living in squats, scavenging for food and raiding skips, and yet she wasn't a student. I'll be asking her how easy it was to live entirely off the stuff other people simply throw away.
Well, we're going to start with Ian McKellen. As I've said, one of our most distinguished actors, not only a Knight of the Realm, but also a Companion of Honour, which is even more prestigious. Younger Radio 4 listeners, which I think are defined as anyone still paying for their own bus fare, will know Sir Ian as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings. Older ones may have enjoyed his performances on stage at the National Theatre and the RSC right back to the 80s, 70s and 60s, when he was a fresh-faced youth just down from Cambridge. He's been in all sorts of films here and in Hollywood. In recent years, he's played Widow Twankey in pantomime. He's been in Coronation Street. But since we have the lead singer of Guillemots with us, perhaps it's only polite to say the high point of his career was appearing in their video Falling Out of Reach a couple of years ago.
Ah, yes.
Yes, but but just recently he's enjoyed great success in Sean Mathias's production of Samuel Beckett's production of Waiting for Godot, which is resuming for a short run at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. So welcome, Sir Ian.
Thank you.
The limited number of times I may refer to you as Sir Ian.
Yes, I think you've run out of time on that, yeah.
So Waiting for Godot was a shortish run already, but very successful, and you're reassembling the cast with a couple of changes.
Yeah, well, I hadn't anticipated when I did it that it was going to be as rewarding as it was, and I thought it was just a play that you did, but it's not like that. It's a bit like Shakespeare. You don't seem to be able to get to the bottom of it as an actor. There's always more to mine and discover, and I felt when we'd finished it that I wanted to go on doing it somehow. Patrick Stewart had another job to go to, so did Simon Cannon, so enter Roger Rees and Matthew Kelly in their parts. Ronald Pickup is still there on the end of the rope.
Now, some people love Waiting for Godot and some people don't like it.
Well, everybody who's seen our production loves it.
Yes.
That's the difference between our production and others.
So does it take a really fine performance, or four fine performances, to make sense? Because it's a play in which, well, I think it's been described as when nothing happens or nothing happens twice.
Well, I think that rather depends on what production you see. And this maybe is unique amongst other productions of Godot, in that everybody cast is the right age. It is a play about old men.
Yes.
Quite clear that the two tramps, as they're called, the homeless people, Vladimir and Estragon, have known each other for 50 years at least. And they've been around and friends, working together in some capacity. We imagine probably in a double act in the theatre. And the set is a ruined theatre where they can't help coming back to as they wait for what? The agent to turn up, or the phone call to come, or Clive Anson say, come and be on Loose End. Anything to escape from the life they're living. And
well, the Prime Minister's waiting for Gordo.
But it's touching to me when people at the stage all said, did you know my father? And I say, no, but he was exactly like you. In other words, he had bad feet like poor old Gogo has, or trouble with his prostate like Vladimir. The first two facts that are established about these two characters is that they are suffering from elements of old age, and so maybe we've tapped into something, a truth about the play that wasn't actually revealed before.
And is it different from you playing it with Roger Rees rather than Patrick Stewart?
Well, it is, and I'm still discovering in what ways it's different, because we've only done a couple of performances. What is the difference? I don't know. Patrick is a very reliable sort of... Well, he's Yorkshire, isn't he? That's a crucial difference.
Roger Rees is not reliable, is that?
He's a little bit more of a flibbertigibbet than Patrick, but deeply concerned with the nature of the world, but not entirely certain how to express it. I'm talking about his his characterisation. And that considerably alters the nature of my affection for him. So it's been an exploration for me as well as for him.
Yes.
And we're still going on the journey.
Well, some critics have been very excited about it being doing so well. There's a couple of people written about the comparison, two productions coming into the West End at the moment. One, Legally Blonde, which I've yet to see, but it's a fun production, whereas Waiting for Godot may be fun, but it's a thought-provoking production and play that does challenge even the regular theatre-goer to concentrate.
It's no secret now, because I keep telling the story, that Sean Mathias and I went to the management of the Theatre Royal Haymarket and said, can we do Waiting for Godot? They said, oh, absolutely not. No, nobody wants to see that play. And when I said I wanted to take it on the road, on tour in the UK, they said, well, you won't get bookings.
No.
Theatres won't book it in. Well, every single seat was sold for every performance on the road and in London. And it turns out to be an extremely popular play.
People, but that may be just you. Maybe, you know.
Well, it may be, but people study it at school. It's a well-known play. It's a famous play, and it doesn't get that many productions. And I don't know, playing it in a large theatre, which again was a difference in this production compared with others, the play was first done in a sort of cellar in London. We did it to 1,600 people in Edinburgh. And it becomes a popular play. And the comedy part of the play emerges. Tragicomedy, Beckett called it. So, I don't know, but it's very pleasing to me that so many good productions are in the West End, commercial productions of plays as opposed to musicals, new plays, some of them, and the revivals like Captain Hot Tin Roof with major performers like James Earl Jones. I mean, we have one of the great actors of our time. Yeah.
So theatre's still hanging on. Often people write it off and say, oh, it's all musicals now, or it'll die because of the parking charges.
Well,
it still goes on, we
couldn't go up until a quarter of an hour late because the queue was so long for people trying to get in. And that's not just us, it's other theatres as well. I don't know. Credit crunch doesn't seem to have affected the theatre, maybe not the class of people who go to the theatre, but then we do have £11 seats.
Yes.
You can get on the front row of our theatre for £11.
Now, you do an amazing range of things. I mentioned in the introduction, for a couple of years, I think you did Widow Twankey or pantomime. Was that something you always wanted to do, a pantomime?
I've always loved pantomime. Yeah. It was the first theatre I ever saw, so I'm very, very grateful to it, because it sparked the fire for me. And I've always admired stand-up comics, of which I'm not one, and so getting into a pantomime, usually played by a stand-up comic, the Dame...
It's sort of like being a stand-up comic, isn't it?
It is a bit. I mean, you do go out there and you're just on your own, but actually the moment of unadulterated pleasure is when you put on the very, very, very large hat at the end, and the gloves, and the high heels, and the skirt, and the corset.
And go home.
Well, you speak for yourself, Clive.
No, the walk down.
You teeter down the steps, and the roar of welcome from an audience that has just, I don't know, let its hair down, in the company of all the generations of the family. I think that's what's nice about it. Kids laugh as much as old people. And it's what theatre should be.
I miss my dose of pantomime. I normally go to the Hackney Empire with Clive Rowe, who's a fantastic pantomime dame.
The best
singer,
pantomime I saw this year was at Theatre Royal Stratford East, very much a homemade pantomime for that audience. And the Dame didn't change her costume once, I think perhaps next time I do it, I'll follow that. It's a good idea.
Oh, no, you've got to keep changing costume.
No, you need a little rest in the dressing room.
You've been mentioning gay sportsmen not coming out. Is this something that you're campaigning for? Because the assumption there must be plenty of homosexual sportsmen, but they never reveal it.
It's very few. Well, I mean, I seem to be campaigning, but actually, it was just a question in an interview like this, and I answered, and it turns out that I am slamming the sports establishment. But actually, I would like to, because players should be encouraged to be themselves, and if they're lying about their sexuality because they're frightened of having bottles thrown at them from the crowd that go to football, then something's wrong with football, but not just football. Gareth Thomas coming out as the great player was a fantastic achievement. And there have been wonderful lesbian sports people in tennis, particularly.
One or two in America have come, but usually after their career is over, and they say, here's an interesting thing in my book, or this is what, looking back.
I mean, there is no excuse for it. In the past, when to be homosexual was illegal and you were put in prison, or as in some parts of the world, actually killed by the state, things are relatively easy in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great pity that the image of sports people as being vibrant people in charge of their own bodies and in charge of their own lives should be belied by the fact that they're too frightened to say, I'm gay.
But do you think it's fear rather than anything else? And do you has anyone...
Well, what else could it be?
Has anyone sort of contacted you and said, oh, I'm glad you said that and I'm going to take your lead? Or has it just been, gone
not
to
at
the
all. And I don't badger individuals to come out. But I do say to them privately, look, you will never be happier than the day you come out because your life will change entirely for the better. It's the best thing I ever did.
All right. Mm. Yes, yes, and that was, about 20 years ago now, so it's quite some time.
Well, it seems a lifetime ago. I was 50, so no, yes, yes, just over 20 years ago.
All right, so
it's kind of a nice thing, isn't it? You were saying that they usually come out after their career is over.
Yeah.
I just imagine Billie Jean King at 40 all going back, going to smash and go, I'm gay! Wins the point. You know,
yes.
They come out during the competition.
That'd be good.
Let's have some music. Now on Loose Ends. Marcus Bonfanti is apparently the sound of the North London blues. Someone once called him the love child of Tom Waits and Van Morrison. Well, she shouldn't mean love child and Van Morrison. That's rather controversial, isn't it? But he releases his album, What Good Am I to You, on Monday and can be seen and heard at Ray's Jazz in London next Thursday at the Lemon Tree, Aberdeen, on the 19th of February. And there's a few other venues as well. Today he's joined by Alex Reeves on drums, Scott Weiber on bass to play, it's Give Me Your Cash. Marcus.
I'm them voices in your conscience. I'm the roof when you get cold. I'm them noises in the nighttime. I ain't getting so old. I'm that monkey on your back. I'm the landlord of your soul. Now rent is due, my boy. And I want it paid in full. Now give me your cash.
Very good. Give me your cash. Excellent. A good motto. Now, let us turn our attention to the World Wide Web, which in the last 20 years, by linking up computers and such like, has managed to transform human knowledge, communication, business and everything. How and why this has happened is explained in a four-part documentary series called The Virtual Revolution, presented by Dr. Alex Krotowski, who writes for The Guardian on Technology and has presented such TV programmes as The Thumb Bandits, and has been named one of the world's top 10 girl geeks.
Oh, you're dredging things up.
I'm not dredging.
Unfortunately, the web, you can't get away with it.
I know. It's the fault of the web, isn't it? Thumb bandits, really.
No.
Anyway, so this is a much more serious programme than that.
Much more serious, absolutely.
And clearly, you could have made this documentary by just sitting at home and doing it on Skype, but I noticed, no. The first scene is you in Africa, with Sir Timothy Berners-Lee.
That's right,
who's played an important part in the web, and you get a trip off to Africa with you, and he gets a trip off to Africa, the both of you. So great. Well done on the documentary. Making front.
Thank you very much. Yes, I was very pleased. We had quite a cast of countries that were included in this as well. Yeah. So, yeah, we went to Africa, we went to Estonia, we went to Moscow, we went to the US, obviously, because there's so much in the US that's going on over there. So it was an amazing adventure.
Because you can go to any country, because the World Wide Web goes everywhere.
It goes everywhere.
So tell us about Sir Timothy. I know, because he's British, we concentrate on him and think. So, was he the only begetter of the World Wide Web, or did he just make a tiny little difference, or what?
He was the guy, basically. There were all these ideas that were floating around about the web, you know, how to link information, how to pull things together. But basically, he was the guy who went, I've got the good idea. Mm. I've got the reason to bring this all together. And that little innovation, that little step made it something that was extraordinary. And what he also did, which is really important, is that he released it for free. There was no price tag on it.
I want to come to that free aspect. But obviously I understand exactly how this works. But how does the little bit of electronic information know where to go? You know, you send it down a line and then it goes around the world. What's driving it to the right place? Is that too technical a question?
Yeah, it is. It's pure unadulterated will, I think, if anything else. If this wasn't radio, then I could draw you a picture. I think that's probably the best thing.
It probably wouldn't make any difference to me. I still wouldn't understand it.
Well, if you imagine it, right, you get a chunk of information like an email, and you want to send it to, I don't know, Richard here.
Yes.
Right? So what happens is that email is split into lots and lots of different pieces. It goes to lots and lots of different places around the web, a bit like a telephone exchange. Those bits of information, do you see where we're going? Completely complex.
Yes.
Then it gets put together.
Why is it split up? Why doesn't it just travel together? You know, like a little convoy of information.
Well, this is actually a really interesting thing, because originally the internet, which is the structure that the web is based on, the internet was developed by the US government, because they basically wanted something that would allow them to communicate and innovate without anybody else knowing, and it being a really solid system that was decentralized. Nothing could actually destroy the web or could destroy the internet. And so that's actually one of the reasons why this information is split up and spread out in different ways. Basically, so nobody can come in and say, right, there you go. I don't like that information. I'm going to switch the internet off. I'm going to switch the World Wide Web
off. Well, you say that, though. Later in the program, you go to one of the 13 places, vital server places, and you sort of imply, sort of contrary to that, that if somebody were to get in there and to smash it all up and destroy it, that would make it wouldn't utterly destroy the whole thing, but it would make a big difference.
I remember, I think it was in 1996, I was still living in the US, and I was staying with my mum, it was just before I moved over, after college, and AOL, which was America Online, was like the biggest web provider in the States, and it was just down the road in Virginia. And something happened, and it broke.
Yes.
And everybody went absolutely mental, because suddenly this thing that they'd relied on was gone.
Somebody had spilled a cup of coffee.
Exactly. Sneezed. But it was incredible. People had to pull out their fax machines. They had to actually communicate with one another, as opposed to, you know, via text. And I've always wondered what would happen if that happened now, because we're so embedded in this culture of technology. But unfortunately, it won't happen.
I made a little documentary on the radio about Wikipedia about a year or so ago, and even I was sort of writing the script, I was like, oh, that can't be right. You know, Wikipedia started in 2001. That can't be the case. It must have been. But you make the point, this stuff, which has transformed the way a lot of us work and operate, has only been around, 20 years, really?
20 years, yeah. The web was effectively invented 20 years ago, and so much of the innovations that we have now, so much of what we do now, has really only been developed in the past 5 or 6 years. You know, Wikipedia is an example of something that's got longevity, but most other stuff is, you know, really fast. It comes in and people use it and then adapt it and build on top of that to create new things. So, you know, the Twitters, the Facebooks, all these social networks, they're only like 2 or 3 years old.
Well, you do make that contrast, as you coming onto there, for Sir Timothy Berners-Lee sort of basically gave it to the world. Jimmy Wales, who with perhaps one or two others created Wikipedia, they do it for nothing. And then you contrast that, well, here's Microsoft and Bill Gates, he's one of the richest. Now, are you making a point there that some people are more generous than others, or that it was necessary for some people to make a profit, or that they should have all just added to the sum of human knowledge by just pooling their resources?
That latter one is an ideal, and I don't necessarily think that would have. I don't think that would have worked. I think it would have remained a real hobbyist's concept. What Bill Gates did and what Microsoft did was it popularized it, because it basically put this web browser, this portal onto the internet, this portal onto the web, Internet Explorer, into what people use for their computers. And suddenly when everybody realized that they had a window they could go on, then it just became this mass phenomenon. But now that everybody has it, it seems right in some ways that we do have more free stuff that's out there, because then people are able to play around with it and then to create new things with it and to advance stuff now that we've actually got something that is mainstream.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm afraid I have to end you there. The virtual revolution begins Saturday. Is it tonight or next Saturday?
Next Saturday.
BBC Two at 8:30. Thank you very much. Now we're going to Richard Herring. Some top-notch comedy from him. His show, Hitler Moustache, was a huge success in Edinburgh, with critics calling it an intelligent, brave and brilliant show, superbly constructed and wickedly clever. So that's why he's taking it and himself on a tour around the UK beginning next Friday. He's got over the top on the moustache front there. But,
it's hidden behind here. It's coming. There it is in the middle.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. So that's in Folkestone, 22nd of April, in Stockton-on-Tees. But you're going to... I've got here to say you've got to give us a taster of your moustache. That sounds a bit unpleasant. a taster, anyway. Richard Herring.
Yes, well, my latest show is called Hitler Moustache, in which I'm trying to reclaim the toothbrush moustache, as it should be called, for comedy, because Charlie Chaplin had it first, then Hitler came along, kind of ruined it for everyone. It's probably the worst thing he ever did. the toothbrush moustache, it was once quite a popular moustache, but now in the 21st century the only place you'll see it is carved into the pubic hair of a naughty lady. Robert Mugabe's got a little one as well. I'll let you draw your own comparisons on that one as well. So how did this little square inch of hair, this nasal welcome mat, why has it taken the blame for all of Hitler's atrocities? Because I don't think it was the moustache that was responsible, yet somehow, along with the name Adolf and the swastika, which was originally a Hindu symbol of peace, we're not allowed to have these things anymore. I wanted to see if I could wrestle Hitler to the ground, kick him in the ball, and take it back for him. But is it possible to reclaim this moustache? Is it wise to try and reclaim this moustache? And I wanted to find out what would happen to me if I went around the streets of Britain with an actual toothbrush moustache grown on my face. Because I did this for 3 months last year. I'm doing it for another 3 months this year, which I'm very much looking forward to. What would happen to me? Was that a wise idea to do? But I want you to know, you can relax. I'm definitely the best stand-up comedian you are ever going to see, so do come and see it. You can. I don't know the meaning of the word hubris, which is a shame, because straight after this I'm taking part in a define the meaning of the word hubris competition. I'm not bothered, though. I think I'm definitely going to win anyway. Some think it's a mistake to put a joke so early that depends on the audience knowing the definition of quite an obscure word. Probably not so bad on Radio 4. You probably all got that, but maybe a knob joke would have been better at that juncture. But I have to say, I am my own worst critic, though my self-criticism is mediocre at best. And and I want you all to know, I'm not one of these sexist, women-hating comedians. I love women. I'm not a sexist. I've actually got a friend who's a woman, so I can't be sexist. I strongly believe that women should be treated as if they're equal. That is my strong belief, so you're in safe hands if you come to the show. But it was fascinating to me that this moustache is on the face of of arguably the funniest man of the 20th century and arguably the most evil man of the 20th century. I'm not talking about Blakey from On the Buses and Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill, but Hitler and Chaplin both had the same mistake. It's fascinating. How can it be funny on one face and evil on the other? Is this the point where comedy and evil meet? It was quite an exciting... Would I become evil if I grew the moustache? Would I become funny? That's a good... good. Well, I want you to know, I'm not the only man you know who has sported the toothbrush moustache. In fact, I'd go as far as saying that every single man you know who is capable of growing a beard and has at any point had to shave it off will have had this moustache. Because what men do in the privacy of their own bathroom when it comes to... They'll try a few different styles. So they'll maybe do a Mexican bandit moustache, maybe try a little David Brent. But the last thing, every single man, he'll go down to the Hitler moustache, he'll do a little Sieg Heil himself in the mirror, laugh about how amusing he has just been, then quickly shave it off for anyone notices. I did all that, but I kept the moustache on. So who's the person you should really worry about? The man surreptitiously growing this moustache in the privacy of his own bathroom, or me proudly wearing it out on the street. And if you see me on the street, please don't beat me up. I'm not looking forward to doing this again. Thank you very much.
Okay, well done, Richard. So you need to dash off and get rid of the beard and just leave the moustache. And you have your hair cut as well, because it's a bit lengthy for Hitler.
It's all just about the moustache. It's not about... Some people were saying I should dress up in SS uniforms and goose step
the
around.
Hair. You could but
it's,
do no, the
because
hair.
It's about the moustache. I'm trying to reclaim the moustache. It's nothing. Okay. I'm not trying to be Hitler.
No.
Someone's tried that. It didn't work out so well.
OK, all right. Well, I think I got the point. Let's go on to Joe Bunting now, who's not trying to be Hitler.
No. At 26, Catherine Hibbert had a job as a journalist. Well, she was a journalist. She rented a flat, got invitations to parties, had a boyfriend and the money for holidays and clothes. Yet life, she writes in her book Free, had become tedious. So she did what we'd surely all do under the circumstances. She gave everything up and went to live in a squat. Catherine, that's quite a radical solution to feeling a little bit bored with your life.
Yeah, you could say that.
You were only 26. What was the aim behind doing that?
Well, there was slightly more to it than just being a bit jaded and, you know, quarter-life crisis or whatever you might want to call it. I had also been made redundant and the rent on my flat had also become pretty much unaffordable. So it was kind of a choice between getting down to the Dole office, moving back to my mum's house, or doing something else. You know, it was at that point where if I'd had a couple of grand in the bank, I might have gone to India to find myself. I couldn't do that, so I went to East London. But the reason why I did that rather than the obviously much more sensible option was that I knew some people who were doing it, and I knew that they were living lives that were actually pretty okay. You know, there was, and you, when you look at the statistics about the waste that's being created, and you look at the fact that there's about 500,000 homes in England and Wales which have been empty for more than 6 months, most of them empty for several years, while you've got people struggling to house themselves. And when you look at the fact that there's 20 million tonnes of food being thrown away every year...
Let's get on to this 20 million tonnes of food, because this intrigued me. So your aim was to try and live off other people's waste, the stuff we throw away, and not spend any money for a year. And now food appeared to be very easy to come by. You seem to be living on M&S chickens all year.
Yeah, well, M&S chickens, but more often duck.
You got sick of the sight of sushi.
I wouldn't imagine squatters. I take the fish off the sushi and like put it in a sandwich because I got so tired of it
bored
as sushi.
Where did you get it from?
Well, all the cafes and restaurants and supermarkets, particularly the ones in central London, which are serving very affluent people and who want kind of convenience and really fresh food, throw away sacks of food every night. You know, you have to be careful with your back lifting up these bags of sushi and
muffins,
cookies, muffins. I got very tired of muffins, but actually food became one of the best ways to spend all this time I now had on my hands.
You scavenge
and you get to know which shops throw out what at what time. You know, for instance, I know now that there's a particular bread shop that if I get there at 5:20, find two sacks of French crusty bread. So you get to know that, and then it's really easy to fit into your day, and you just cycle to where it is.
You make it sound very simple, but actually you did meet with some resistance, because oddly these outlets have thrown it away, stuck it outside in the bin bags waiting to be collected, but hated the idea of someone like yourself coming along and getting their free bit of day-old lemon drizzle.
Yeah,
cake.
And I don't mean to...
Seems a bit mean of them.
Well,
but they
it
were
is.
Like
you do
that,
get
they?
Into sort of ridiculous situations where you've got the...
you know, whatever it might be, crispy duck pancakes out of the bin, and some shop assistant comes out. And usually they would just like, look, I'm really sorry, would you mind putting that back? Because it's my job to tell you to put it back. But sometimes they'd be really angry. Like, so I had this woman coming out, a little tiny woman going, get out of that rubbish! It might be rubbish, but it's our rubbish! Put it back!
And your point would be, why don't you lot stop producing quite so much food? It's not needed. You're overproducing, and you can afford to throw it away. Your profit margins are so big.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, that it just goes to show what the extra price you're paying on top of the cost of the raw materials does pay for this stuff. I mean, either produce less, or what's wrong with reducing it more heavily at the end of the day so that, you know, people can buy it, or give it to the various redistribution charities that are trying to dish it out to the people who really need it. Or if you have got to throw it away, just let people get on with taking it. No, don't throw blue dye over it or open all the packets.
We're running out of time, really. I just want to quickly ask you about the squatting, which I filmed in squats for many a non-award-winning regional documentary, Catherine. And they were grim. Yours actually seemed to be not too bad. You all wore hand-knitted jumpers, lived off sushi, swung in hammocks. And where were the drug addicts and the violence and the mental illness? It must surely be out there, or have I got the wrong impression?
No, it certainly is out there. And most people who are living in squats are doing it because they're in very difficult financial circumstances. But, you know, there's about 20,000 squatters in the UK, most of whom are doing their best to get by in a kind of civilised way under very difficult circumstances. And that means making sure that the people around you are people who are not going to do you harm, making sure that your living place is kind of safe and clean and has sofas and beds and hot water and all the things that...
All scavenged from skips.
Or built for yourself, or, you know, generally... sorting things out so that you can live comfortably.
It did actually, I'll be honest with you, it sounded like hard work.
Yeah,
not working, but just squatting sounded like hard work. You can read about it in Catherine's book. She's still living in a squat, and she's written a book about her experience. It's published by Ebury Press. It's called Free, and ironically costs $11.99.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe and Catherine. We're squatting now with some music. Fife Dangerfield is no stranger to the Loose End studio, but normally he's with his band Guillemots. This time, however, he's flying solo with his new album Fly Yellow Moon. And going it alone has provided no bad thing for him, with reviewers giving him lots of praise, calling his love songs pop perfection and describing him as a great songwriter on top form. Well, Fife's here on piano, not quite alone, because he's accompanied by Charlie Stock and Lisa Ratz on viola and violin to perform his single She Needs Me. Fife Dangerfield.
When my days are rolling stones, when my memories ring like telephones, then I'll have somewhere I can go. I'll have comfort, this one thing I know. Turquoise stream, leaves of amber, fields of emerald green. sketch all those shades on me. I am yours, you can do what you like with me.
Dangerfield. So let's come to David Throffel, who's back in the seventh series of Shameless, Channel 4's unforgiving drama set in an unrelentingly awful Manchester housing estate. As in the first six series, David plays Frank Gallagher, a wastrel, drunk, drug user, who at the beginning of the programme, in an opening poem, invites us to watch pikeys making a mess of their lives. So to people who haven't seen it, would you say it's a comedy, a tragedy, a soap opera?
I think it's
opera?
A drama.
Drama. Yeah.
Yeah, I won't have all this compartmentalisation.
No.
Like, it happens to be funny.
Yes.
But, I mean, that you know, there are things that one reads every day in the paper that you get the studio and you start pinning them up and you go, you can't write this stuff, can you? And
yes.
You can't. So I think it's a drama and it's...
Essentially, everybody in it is sort of constantly making the wrong choice.
What do you mean by wrong?
Well, if there's something there they could get by working, or something can steal, they'll steal it. If the girl is going to go off with the right man, she'll get sidetracked to the wrong man. It's a sort of.
Oh, you mean life?
Yes, well, it's like life. would that be the defining aspect of the people's lives that you're portraying?
I just think that they're sometimes the only choices they can make, rather than you know wrong ones. I think if we were getting it, I mean, sometimes look, if you've got a drama series going for seven series, then you're bound to be up for the odd pop. And I think that sometimes, as we've gone on, they've said that some people, perhaps outside knowing what the situations are like on council estates, up and down the country. That I've spoken to say that, you know, that's pretty much, you know, how it is. Yeah. But the people who live outside, it sometimes think we're perhaps patronising, taking a view on people. But I don't think
or exaggerating.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's. I don't believe we are. And I think if we were getting it wrong in that way, I think the people who come up to me or other people in the streets would let us know. So
yes,
I think it's just. I think it is reflective of the way. People have got to get by. I mean, Catherine's stories, you know, that kind of thing about how you get by in this country.
But is it a call to arms in any respect? Because, you know, there was a time when something like Cathy Come Home or a drama like that was on television. It was an impulse to some actual action. Now, the first series or two of Shameless, it was quite shocking to people. So what's going on here? As you say, it is funny. There are jokes in it. But there are serious issues being discussed in this... week in particular, without wishing to get too serious in the discussion, the awful things that go on, people in deprived circumstances,
terrible,
in poverty, or they pick up violence at home. I mean, are you and the other makers of this programme hoping to make an impact beyond providing entertainment, but to actually make people think?
Well, if you go back originally, I mean, Paul Abbott, who's the creator, he wrote it as a very dour, I don't know which company I'm in here to say
dour
drama, yeah. George Favourite Company, who, so he said, why don't you just take another look at this and do it in a different way? I mean, we're chatting before, I'm similar to Ian or Richard, I love stand-up comedy and things that I know, music hall. And Paul has that similar kind of mindset. And he took a view that you can, what we try to do on the show is to portray it as it is, which is the drama, and then just sort of pull the rug to make the point. Yes. I mean, I think if it was a Cathy Come Home Call to Arms, I think it would be less entertaining for those people that haven't seen it.
Yeah. I mentioned that you sometimes direct it. It is always directed in quite a snappy way. Things
snappy,
move along.
It's very snappy. Yes, yeah. That's absolutely right. Jolly snappy, very fast. It's the visualization, the way that, you know, even the directors of photography who come on, they have to slightly revamp their own technique in order to do it in that way. And I think there's some shows that have come after it have borrowed that style as well.
Have you always directed episodes, or did you just sort of take it over and thought, you know, I'd like to do that?
I take it over. Yeah. Well, obviously, what I did was one day in the bathroom, I did that Hitler moustache thing, yeah. And I thought, why can't I take this over? You know, you cheeky thing. It was just a chance, I was saying to Ian before, for Mark one night with George and Paul that I'd always wanted to direct. I was art college trained and not that you can tell. But, you know, the visual thing had always interested me. And being in a room, working it out with actors has always been fascinating. So that happened from sort of series three.
Yeah.
They gave me a go, and it seems to have worked out. And I absolutely love it.
Yes.
And it gives me a chance, too, on the show to work with the people that I work with most days for the last so many years in a slightly different way, you know, that I'd have conversations. And you get to know the people and not just the actors, you know.
So you're a director, you're an executive producer as well. So this means you're always going to be there. You're going to be... become the sort of Ken Barlow of the programme, that you'll be there in 20, 30 years' time. I didn't quite hear that, luckily.
Yes, Clive, that's right. That's absolutely correct. Well, I mean, since one has dropped out of option year on year, I mean, we're doing some more. I mean, it's the first time next year, for example, that we're going to do 22.
All right.
So it's the first time a British drama has been... And we're going to keep doing it until we get it right, Ian.
do you have guest actors in it?
Won't you be in New Zealand?
Yeah. not in 20
yes, we
years'
do.
Time.
Well, he's done Coronation Street. Why can't he do Shameless?
I'm sure one could arrange... Yeah. Something.
Well, at the beginning of the series, you're... This is great if we could do it, because you're entering into a relationship. We don't know how it's going with the librarian, played by Pauline McLean. There could be a senior librarian, played by Sir Ian. Anyway, that's loose ends wrapped up for this. My thanks to all my guests, David Threlfall, Dr. Alex Krotowski, Sir Ian McKellen, Fife Dangerfield, Marcus Bonfanti, and Richard Herring, Joe Bunting, and Catherine Hibbert. Thank you for listening. I'm Clive Anderson. Next week, my guests will include the latest Bond girl, Gemma Arterton. But for me, for now, goodbye.
Loose Ends was presented by Clive Anderson. The producer was Cathy Marnie.